It's 2:06 on the John Phillips Show, Talk Radio 790 KABC, broadcasting live in exile from the Morongo Casino Resort and Spa Living Room Studios, and it's time to fully reopen the state of California for business. Mr. Randy Wang's at the sports desk in Culver City.
John, President Joe Biden is in Michigan today talking about his economic plans, and he brought the not jokes.
And Michigan will once again become the manufacturing hub of the nation, and that's not a joke.
And, of course, in any Joe Biden stump speech, he rambles on forever about stories about his pappy, and he tripled up the resets after this.
My dad used to have an expression, and I mean it sincerely. Matter of fact, it was quoted to me today by one of the congressmen.
Yeah, I don't believe that.
He used to say, Joey, a job is about a lot more than a paycheck. It's about your dignity. It's about your place in your community. Literally, not a joke. Think about it.
Literally, not a joke. Think about it.
Now, since the fake doctor is trying out her new material later today with George Gascon at a joint press conference, maybe they can invite Joe Biden to participate in the next one, and they can really have a comedy showcase.
Literally, not a joke. Think about it.
In fact, I got to pull up. Let's see right now if this press conference has started yet. Nope, the Instagram page is live, and I got reporters looking at this, and there's a podium there, but so far, we have no Ferrer, we have no Gascon, but I'll let you know what happens with this joint presser on Gascon. Oh, Gascon's going up to the podium. I'll let you know what happens later. Oh, and Ferrer's got a mask on, but Gascon doesn't.
Uh-oh, she's going to lecture him.
She's the only one on the stage wearing a mask. I'm going to listen to this while you do your next interview.
Well, if they decide to invite Biden and they become a comedy team, they're going to have to come up with a spiffy new name because the Three Stooges has already been taken. 800-222-KABC is the telephone number, 1-800-222-5222. It is a pleasure to welcome our next guest to the program. He is the Director of External Affairs at the Manhattan Institute and a contributing writer to the City Journal. You can follow him on Twitter at Jesse_LEG. Jesse Arm, welcome.
How's it going, John? Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for stopping by. Well, you have a new piece out in City Journal that's an interesting one because it is an issue that a lot of people are wrestling with right now, trying to decide which way they're going to come down in the next Republican primary, where you've got Donald Trump already out saying he's running for office, and you've got the 800-pound gorilla in Florida in Ron DeSantis, who just won re-election by 20 points, and instead of engaging in all of the national antics that are going on right now in terms of presidential politics, he's just keeping his head down, and he's focusing on getting win after win after win in the state of Florida. You wrote about these two different approaches, and you believe that one is certainly better than the other.
Yeah, I think that's true, John. You know, I wrote my piece a little bit about a concept that actually began on the left called popularism. That's not populism, spelled a little bit differently. I had a couple letters in there. Popularism was actually created by a pollster on the left by the name of David Shore. He was a hard left guy, democratic socialist, working in a very left-wing democratic polling firm a few years ago, and began to have the audacity to tell his higher-ups that some of the ideas that he believed in and that their candidates were championing were, well, very unpopular with the American electorate. So he went ahead and said, listen, there's some stuff we support that's very popular. Medicaid being able to renegotiate prices with the government. I think it's a bad idea, but it happens to be popular with a lot of voters. Stuff like defunding the police, defunding immigration cops is deeply unpopular with all Americans. So he said, let's change the approach. Let's lean into the issues on which voters agree with us on, and we'll see more success at the ballot box. The crux of my piece says, all right, this is actually the United States of America, for the most part, is a center-right country. You ask voters how they feel about cutting up the genitals of children or separating kids in grade school on the basis of the pigmentation in their skin. A lot of these crazy left-wing cultural issue debates that we have currently, about 70%, 80% of Americans actually see things the way conservatives do in this country. So I said, why don't we take this concept and make it a popularism for the right And I think Ron DeSantis in Florida has a really good blueprint with how he's governed in the past couple of years since COVID, a good sense of sort of how to be a political entrepreneur. What are the issues on which broad swaths of the American electorate agree with conservatives on? And how do we make those the front and center issues that we talk about in elections, not some of the more contentious stuff like relitigating the 2020 presidential election?
Well, you look at the subjects that Republicans ran on and won on in the elections that they did come out on top in. Essentially, it was three different subjects, and it doesn't matter which region of the country you're talking about. It was the economy and inflation, crime, and the border. And when I hear some of these electeds go on television and they're talking about what they plan on doing when the new Congress takes over, and they talk about investigating Hunter Biden's laptop, or they talk about trying to put new restrictions on abortion or any number of other subjects, I say to myself, that's not what you ran on. You did not run on that. You told the people that if you got elected, you were going to do something about the economy. You're going to do something about crime. You're going to do something about the border. Go do something about that, and you'll have broad public support behind you. You start getting involved in these other boutique subjects, and you're going to lose next time around.
I tend to agree with you. Listen, it's not that Hunter Biden should get off scot-free for whatever shenanigans or influence peddling he was involved in. It's just a matter of putting our heads down and governing and delivering for our voters. Ron DeSantis is a great example of this. He didn't actually run on a lot of these gender issues and culture issues and race issues, but he saw what was going on. Take the COVID lockdowns, for example. Listen, this concept of popularism is not only about following what the polls say. It's about having a sense of what's right, what's wrong, and what will become popular, and having the courage to identify those issues and lean into them, and then communicate the value of your decisions to the voters after the fact. DeSantis gets this right on COVID, right? We had lockdowns across the country. DeSantis was the first person to open up his state in Florida, or among the first legislators in the country to talk about the fact that outdoor transmission really wasn't a thing. We didn't have a whole lot to be afraid of. We didn't need to be hiding our children and keeping them out of schools and masking them up. So he went out there and he began to change things. It was very unpopular at the time. Even Donald Trump was at this point, ceding the press podium at the White House to Anthony Fauci, telling, you know, the country that they should listen to Fauci and Birx and, you know, go with their guidance. But DeSantis took the unpopular route, but it became popular over time. I think we need to embolden more leaders within the party who have the courage to do that.
People seem to think it's crass when you say that elections are popularity contests, that you have to be more popular than your opponent, otherwise you lose and they win. But that's the truth. We have these winner-take-all elections. It's not like a parliamentary system in Europe where you get whatever percent of the pie that your team got on election day. If you don't get more votes than your opponent, they get complete control over whatever office it is that you're running for, and that's the way it works. If you don't take positions that have broad popularity, and positions, by the way, on subjects that really need a lot of attention on. I mean, the fact that the border is in such a crisis state that it's in right now is beyond my ability to comprehend. If you go and you do something about that, my God, not only is your side going to be happy with you, but you're going to get a lot of people who aren't particularly ideological who can make the connection, oh my God, the border used to be chaotic and now it's not.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, John. You know, I'll again go back to, you mentioned crime. So let's go to New York. What happened in New York, right? You had a red state governor. You know, I think actually in the end of the day, Lee Zeldin, running in a deep blue state in New York, ran with crime front and central as his main issue. And he actually ended up getting more votes in New York State than Dr. Oz did in Pennsylvania. Dr. Oz was a funny candidate. He was actually more moderate than a lot of the other candidates that Trump endorsed, typically political novices, folks who skated through the primary thanks to his backing. But Zeldin ran ahead of him in New York. Why was that? I think that's because he made his campaign simple. He made it about an issue that everybody was concerned about in our backyard here where the Manhattan Institute is. And he said, this is important. I'm running on this. I'm not going to change your abortion laws. I understand that this is a deep blue state. And he ran the way he could and did about as good as he possibly could have. you know, guys who aren't necessarily my favorite governors in the country on policy, but who won in deep blue states like Larry Hogan in Maryland or Charlie Baker in Massachusetts, you know, saw their preferred candidates lose in the primaries to Trump-backed, hard-right, election denier types who ended up going on and losing those states and sending them back into Democratic control. I don't think that's the right path. We saw a lot of these Trump-backed candidates, folks who, you know, echoed the president's message on 2020 and made that a centerpiece of their campaign, not just the issues you talk about like crime or the border or some of these culture war issues that I've alluded to. You know, they failed to kind of take what I call the DeSantis route, create your own agenda, govern on new issues, pass new bills, be a political entrepreneur, identifying the culture war debates on which broad majorities of the electorate agree with us, governing on those issues, running on those issues, and then winning by 20 points in a purple state like Florida, where Trump only won by 6 points in 2020.
We're speaking with Jesse Arm, who's the Director of External Affairs at the Manhattan Institute. You can also read him online and in the pages of the City Journal. You can follow him on Twitter at Jesse_LEG. Jesse, let's take what you learned.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, live from Detroit, and you can attend in person for free.
Welcome to the NFL Draft.
See the next NFL stars and experience the ultimate NFL fan festival, featuring live concerts, interactive games, player autographs, and more. The NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, April 25th through 27th. Visit NFL.com/draft access to register for free entry today.
The Rolling Stone Music Now podcast gets inside the biggest stories with Rolling Stone senior writer Brian Hyatt.
Now here is my conversation with Jacob Knoll. Your story is an amazing one, and obviously you lost your dad when you're only 1 year old.
It was definitely a screwy way to grow up. I think that a lot of people never heard of who I am, and then they see me join this band, and they must think this kid must have just handed everything, or nepotism kid. It's a gift that I have an opportunity to sing in such a big band like my father and my uncle's band, Sublime.
Rolling Stone Music Now, wherever you listen.
From DeSantis in Florida, your what you describe as conservative popularism, and try to help us in California who are looking for some angle to try to bring sanity back to government here in California. Gavin Newsom, who when you talk to Uber drivers, when you talk to people in the bars, when you talk to people in the diners, they all complain about him. But when he puts his name on the ballot, the guy wins in blowouts every single time. He won his first term in a blowout, he won the recall in a blowout, and he won his second term in a blowout here in the state of California. If we try to use the concept of conservative popularism to get back in the game here in California, what does that look like?
Yeah, well, let's compare and contrast the mayoral election you guys had in Los Angeles just this year with the recall election from a year prior. Clearly, there's some dissatisfaction with Newsom. A lot of dissatisfaction with Newsom. He doesn't have very high approval ratings. He actually only won by a very small margin. When you look at, like, Ron DeSantis blew out his Democratic challenger in Florida, which is a much more purple state than California, by a far greater margin than Newsom won by in deep blue California. But look at the mayoral election in Los Angeles. Look, Rick Caruso ran technically as a Democrat. Folks who have been observing the world of politics for a long time know that Caruso is somebody who has given a lot of money to Republicans over the years, who has identified as a Republican for the majority of his public life, and ran really primarily on the issues of, again, I'm going to, you know, toughen up the police. I'm going to get tougher on crime. That was one of his main issues. The other issue was, I'm going to do something about public corruption. And number three, I'm going to do something about homelessness and mental illness. I'm going to take these people off of the streets, whether they want to go or not. Karen Bass ran more as the kind of establishment Democratic candidate, said, don't believe what's in front of your eyes. The situation is not really as bad as you believe it to be. And she won by a lot slimmer margin than Gavin Newsom won a year ago in the recall election against Larry Elder. Now, Rick Caruso ran with a D next to his name, but it's the policies that really matter. You've got a top two system, a jungle primary system in California. That means you're probably not going to be seeing Republicans with too much success just because of the nature of political polarization in your state and across the country. But you get more sane kind of minded Democrats like Rick Caruso types running, you may see a greater propensity for success in the near future, hopefully not so long term.
Is the partisan
you saw it in
poll-
the
go ahead.
In the prosecutor election in San Francisco, too, the district attorney race with Chesa Boudin. People have had enough. Hopefully you'll have some success with recalling George Cascone in the not-too-distant future as well.
You know, it used to be, and it still is, in some of the states that you mentioned, where you have a partisan pull in federal races because there's a team that you cheer for and a team that you root against. But that didn't necessarily translate to state and local races because you have to live there. And you may have an ideology that you believe in, and you may have a team that you cheer for, but you don't want to be murdered when you're pumping gas. And you want your kids to be in school learning something. And you don't want to have a homeless encampment right outside your house. So even though you may cheer for a particular team, for the community that you live in, you want someone who's going to get results, because if they don't, you're going to have to deal with the consequences on a daily basis. It almost seems that now, though, the partisan pull that exists in federal races has spilled over into state and local races, and people are just willing to put up with the homeless encampment outside their house, or the schools that were shut down for over a year, or the crime that makes it so that they have to do their grocery shopping at 7 in the morning just so they can go in and pull the lever for their team.
Yeah. Listen, John, I live in a city. Unfortunately, here in New York, we've got I'm a registered Republican, so I don't have the opportunity to vote in the Democratic primary race, which is really the only race that matters in electing our mayor. But look back a year here to the Democratic primary in New York City. Eric Adams, leaving the way he's actually governed as mayor aside, he ran on a platform similar to Caruso's. He was going to do something about crime. He was not only against defunding the police, he was for funding the police more. And he made that a real core centerpiece of his campaign. And he won. And he beat candidates who were far more progressive than him, who were unwilling to toe those lines. And Adams won on the backs of hardworking voters that lived in the outer boroughs of New York City, people who, you know, worked tough jobs, who would have to ride the subway, whether they liked it or not. They didn't have laptop jobs that they were doing from their apartments on the Upper West Side throughout the pandemic. These were people who had to go to work and had and saw the degradation of their city happen over time. And they, you know, dealt with the impact of crime, homelessness, and mental illness run amok, and they supported him. You know, I think a similar situation will play out in other cities over time. Minneapolis, which was really the epicenter of the 2020 summer riots, Black Lives Matter, targeting federal buildings, police stations, public, you know, places like Target, et cetera. You know, they voted in 2021 against a ballot measure that would have defunded the police. So I think you're seeing a pivot in these communities. Doesn't necessarily mean they're going to vote for people with an R next to their name, but you're going to see more political entrepreneurs, Rick Caruso types, Eric Adams types, who have political success because the conditions in cities have just gotten so damn bad.
Jesse Arm, Director of External Affairs at the Manhattan Institute, contributing writer to City Journal. You can follow him on Twitter at Jesse_LEG. Jesse, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thanks so much for having me, John. I really appreciate it.
The widow of a late El Monte police sergeant announced earlier today a $25 million claim against L.A.'s pro-criminal district attorney, George Gascon, and other parties stemming from the ambushed death of her husband and his partner back in June, saying that the Paris killer should have been incarcerated at the time because of his prior criminal record. The woman's name is Janine Paredes. She's the wife of Sergeant Michael Paredes, and her claim is a possible forerunner of a lawsuit. Also names as respondents the county, the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office, and the County Probation Department, alleging wrongful death and emotional distress. Her attorney is Michael Peacock. He is kind enough to join us. Michael, thanks so much for stopping by.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's Mark, by the way.
Oh, I'm sorry. It said Michael here at Fox 11. Anyway, fake news. All right, let's get to this lawsuit, because this is a lawsuit that I believe needs to go through and needs to be successful, because we have a district attorney who not only is responsible for this idiotic policy that directly led to the death of this man and others, but he is absolutely insistent that the policy is the correct one, and he is not going to change the policy. Unless something happens, people will continue to die because this guy is digging in his heels. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with you completely. And the thing that needs to happen is Mr. Gascon needs to step down and walk away. You know, all of his policies, as you correctly summarized, have led to the death of two valiant police officers. So what more do you need, George, to step down? You failed in your job. Step down. You know, all you got to do is hop on a plane and go to San Francisco and see what he did up there. Come down to L.A., see what he did to L.A., what he's doing to L.A. I completely agree with you. The law enforcement community is pissed off, to say the least, about what this is doing, not only to the people of L.A. County, but to the culture that these officers have to work within. It's compromised and handcuffed them, all of them. And it's time to stop it. If anybody wants to get a sense for what this guy is all about, hop in the car, drive down to downtown L.A., and drive around and just take a look and think about what it used to look like 10, 15, 20 years ago. See what it looks like now. And in part, he's responsible for all that. He's responsible for Officer Brady's death.
I would imagine that as an attorney that deals with lawsuits like this, you deal with situations all the time where someone did something wrong, someone is damaged, and it's up to the criminal justice system, the court system, to take that wrong and right the wrong, whether it be criminally, whether it be civilly. In your case, it's civilly. And certainly there's a very strong element of that going on with this lawsuit. However, this one, I think, is a little bit different in the sense that, yes, we're righting a wrong, or at least attempting to right some of the wrong. We can't bring him back from the dead, so we can't make the family whole. But we can certainly, hopefully, punish them monetarily. But also, this is about making sure it doesn't happen again. Because unless this guy feels the sting, unless the Board of Supervisors starts getting upset at the policies and the payouts and those sorts of things, this is not going to change. This is going to stay the way it is. And you're going to have another grieving family. You're going to have other people who are murdered who don't have to be murdered.
You're right. You're absolutely right. It's not about the money. People look at, you know, these figures and they go, oh, it's about the money. It's not about the money. If Janine, you're talking with Janine, Mike's wife, his widow. You ask her what she wants. And she articulated it this morning, so she would tell you, I want to make sure that this doesn't happen to anybody else. And the only way to ensure that is to get this guy out and take all your policies, George, and go, because it's not working. It's not working. The objective, the primary objective, frankly, is to effectuate change. Stop it. And because you are correct, this will continue to repeat. And it's really, he should be embarrassed. By the way, when I say he, I mean Gascon. He should be embarrassed. I heard his explanation and reasoning on why this guy didn't need to be in custody. It's ridiculous. Say that to the family, George. How do you think the family feels? The family feels that you should do your job. You had a job. And by the way, it's not your laws, George, to change around whenever you want. Those are the laws that have been in effect for a long time, the three strike laws, all of that, even the probation stuff. All that has been in place for a very, very long time. Just do your job. Let the legislators change the rules. Let the legislators change the laws. Let the courts deal with whether or not they're being applied correctly and things like that. You just do your job. If he had done his job, this man would have been in custody, and this would not have happened. And guess what? You know, one of the reasons why we're talking about it is because it's two officers. So it does have some public pull. But what about all those other people out there that this has now affected them in some way? I'm going to be very curious to see how many cases like this are out there because of this guy's failed policies.
Well, there should be a lawsuit for every single person that's murdered that doesn't have to be murdered, because this is something that he knows about. He's not going.
When you have sports mixed with your pop culture, along with humor and celebrity interviews, your earbuds are enjoying the Rich Eisen Show.
Kevin Millar, we're all paying rent in Ohtani's world, right?
And the Dodgers world. Game is healthy. Game is good. And, you know, I get asked a lot, is that good for baseball? Yeah, it's good for baseball. This is definitely the team to beat, because that should be your next correction, Richie, is this World Series a bust for the Dodgers and Dave Roberts?
Hell yeah. Search for the Rich Eisen Show on YouTube or wherever you listen.
Into this naive. He's going into this eyes wide open. He knows that as a direct result of his policies, people are going to die. But he is so married to his ideological beliefs, he's willing to sacrifice people.
He is. And that's disgusting. And how in 2022, how is it that we're allowing that to happen? Why is this happening? It's completely outrageous. And when you're sitting there talking with the kids of a fallen officer, I'm telling you, man, it breaks your heart. And you go, this was completely, utterly avoidable. That he owes many, many people a great explanation and a huge apology for what he's done.
He was sitting down for an interview once. I think it was with CBS News. And he was asked why he doesn't meet with so many of the victims of crime in Los Angeles County. And he essentially said, well, there's a lot of victims of crime. I don't have time to meet with them. And
yeah,
he
lovely.
Sometimes is followed around by protesters, primarily the family members of crime victims who are upset at his policies. And he dismisses them, too. He essentially says that they're too dumb to understand what's going on in Los Angeles County, all the reform that we're doing here and how great it is for the county. And they're being manipulated by outside forces. As someone who represents the widow of someone who was murdered in Los Angeles County as a direct result, again, of Gascon's policies, how does she feel treated by Gascon?
She's so upset, pissed off about it. She's, you know, she doesn't even want to do interviews. That's how upset she is about it. I mean, you think about where she's coming from, her protectors, her high school sweetheart. They were together 24 years, the father of her two kids. You know, you don't think that she's got some questions and she wants to say something to his face? Absolutely. Absolutely. And for him to be dismissive like that, the way you described it, and anybody wants to get a flavor for the guy, you can just YouTube him, or you get on the Google and you can see how he responds to people. It's disgusting. He's a public servant. A public servant. He is, part of his job is to answer to the public, right? I mean, why is that? He should meet with these people. He should do that. He should see what his policies are creating and what they're doing to hardworking, good, decent people. It's, you know, the piss offness goes beyond Janine. It goes into the whole law enforcement community. I represent law enforcement for a living. And I can guarantee you, I've yet to hear somebody say something good about Mr. Gascon. The policies, they're utter failure.
How often do you speak to people who work for that office, who are career prosecutors, who are career investigators, people who have devoted their lives to putting criminals behind bars and making sure there is a sense of public safety in Los Angeles County? They were there. Many of them were there prior to Gascon, when Jackie Lacey was there and Steve Cooley and DAs before him. The ones that I've spoken to feel unbelievably frustrated. Morale is at an absolute record low in that office because they understand that George Gascon is trying to destroy public safety from within that office and is actively trying to circumvent them from doing their job. And they know that every day. And that's the most frustrating thing in the world, to show up to do a job when you know that your boss fundamentally wants you to fail at it.
I know. That's very well stated. And to answer your question, many of them. I was just at a hockey game the other night with one of them. And guess what? That person was expressing all kinds of frustration about what goes on inside that office. And yeah, that they do feel handicapped. They do feel handicapped by it because they're not allowed to do their jobs. And the same is true with the law enforcement, though. They're not allowed to do their jobs. They put somebody, a criminal, a known criminal, they hook them up and they get them into custody, they bring them back, and guess what? The DA's office won't charge them because of Gascon's, like, progressive, freaky policies. How do you think the police feel about it? They don't feel very good about that. And then all of a sudden, you get up into the DA's office and you get these prosecutors. They can't do the same thing. They're like, we're not going to prosecute on these cases. So guess what? These criminals get back out on the streets and they continue doing the chaotic madness that they do. And what does Gascon do? He blames, he shifts, he doesn't answer questions, he won't meet with the victims' families. That's outrageous. He should be ashamed of himself.
What do you say to people who think that we've hit rock bottom, there's only one place to go, crime can't get any worse, Gascon can't do any more damage? What do you say to them?
Hey, listen, the bottom keeps getting deeper and deeper and deeper. Okay, that's if you don't do something about something, it's going to keep getting deeper and deeper and more ugly, more chaotic. It is time. It's time to do something here. It is time. And guess what? You've now experienced the loss of two police officers who are out there protecting you guys. It is time. And guess what? How many people have to die? How many people have to suffer through all this sort of madness before people actually begin to do something? So the time is now. It's time for Gascon to step down. That's time for that DA's office to clean itself up, tighten back up. The probation department, too, they have got to do their job. I don't want to hear any excuses about COVID and, you know, geez, it's so difficult meeting these people. That's ridiculous. That's absolutely ridiculous. The entire department, the entire LA County Department of District Attorney's Office, they need to get their stuff together. And it can happen. And by the way, lawsuits and claims and whatnot, they do work to effectuate change. And that's the primary objective of doing this, is to effectuate change.
Well, I look forward to this lawsuit moving forward because I want you to be standing in front of 12 men and women who are sitting on that jury and look them in the eye and make your case. And I want Gascon to stand before those 12 men and women of a jury and try, or at least attempt, to look them in the eye and defend what he did, because what he did is the indefensible. And I don't think there's any way he wins in a court of law at all.
I can't wait for that moment, John. I agree with you. I can't wait for that moment. I'd love to see 12 jurors downtown LA looking at him, judging him. I'd love that. It's going to come.
I want to come, believe me. Mark Peacock.
Right. We'll put you on the...
I'll definitely show up to jury duty that day. Mark Peacock, exactly. Thanks so much for stopping by and best of luck in your lawsuit.
Okay, I appreciate it, John. Take care. Be good.
When you have sports mixed with your pop culture, along with humor and celebrity interviews, your earbuds are enjoying the Rich Eisen Show.
Kevin Millar, we're all paying rent in Ohtani's world, right?
And the Dodgers world. Game is healthy. Game is good. And, I get asked a lot, is that good for baseball? Yeah, it's good for baseball. This is definitely the team to beat, because that should be your next correction, Richie, is this World Series a bust for the Dodgers and Dave Roberts?
Hell yeah. Search for the Rich Eisen Show on YouTube or wherever you listen.